Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to another episode of Real Science Friday. I'm Bob Enyart.
And I'm Fred Williams, software engineer and creation speaker.
We're going through this great issue of Creation Magazine, Fred, and they have an article here about spiral galaxies and the bulge that's in the middle of the galaxies. Evolutionary theory, they believed that when they look at the stars in that bulge, that they would see that they don't have nice, neat orbits, but they would swarm almost randomly about the disturbed galaxy's core. They figure that there have been all these collisions and all, so they expect it to look like a mess.
Yeah, they think because of the Big Bang and the way things formed, right, mm-hmm. that collisions seem to be part of their
right.
cosmology.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. There's some cosmologists here that were reporting that from detailed images from the Hubble telescope, they said what they observed was something of a shock.
Something of a shock. We hear
there's that buzzword again.
It's all
one of those
time.
Words. It's surprise, shock,
horrified, and
unbelievable.
Fred,
not
when
expected.
They say this, if you make a wild prediction, like if I say, I think my wife is going to show up at the studio at 4:31 this afternoon. It's 4:31 and she doesn't show up. I wouldn't be shocked.
Yeah.
But if I said, you know, the sun is going to set later this evening. And if it didn't, I'd be shocked.
You'd be shocked.
So
we all would be.
Yeah. You're not shocked when you make some kind of wild prediction and it doesn't come to pass. That's not shocking. But when you make a prediction based on your core worldview, your paradigm, the Big Bang or Darwinism, natural selection, those predictions that they make that are so obvious, when they turn out to be false, that's when you have a legion of scientists saying they're shocked. Every day of the week, relentlessly.
Yeah. This is a prediction that they expect to be true for naturalism, right?
They expect. We could give so many examples of this just regarding stars and solar systems and all. So these guys, they said it was something of a shock. And here's why. They say because the orderly trajectory of the stars and what they're calling oddly pristine spiral galaxies, Fred, pristine, oddly because they don't believe that God design these galaxies. They think they're just accidents. So they say they're oddly pristine, but these stars have orderly trajectories that just doesn't fit with their ideas about violent mergers in the past.
Yeah, so this is from the New Scientist magazine. They added that nagging doubts are creeping in that some of the largest, most luminous examples, in fact, look rather too perfect.
Too perfect. Isn't that a beautiful example of what the Bible says in Psalm 19, that the heavens declare the glory of God?
Absolutely.
Right? So these galaxies are too perfect. They're not the result of a jumbled mess. Just like Darwin's blob, the cell is a blob of protoplasm. No, it's brilliant perfection. And it turns out so are the bulges in the spiral galaxies. Then they also quote Princeton University's cosmologist, Jim Peebles. What does he admit
to? He says that it's wildly unexpected. Another buzzword.
Wildly unexpected, shocked, too perfect. Boy, they got problems,
yeah,
Fred.
He says that galaxies are complicated and we don't really understand how they form. It's really an embarrassment. That's what he said.
He said it's an embarrassment. It's just like those scientists who said they were horrified to see how different the chimp Y chromosome is compared to the human Y chromosome. So, Fred, these are predictions that have failed, and these are not wild, strung-out predictions by somebody who's high on crack cocaine. These are basic presumptions of the Big Bang and of Darwinism, and that's why when they say we're surprised, we're shocked, we're horrified, we're embarrassed, we don't understand it. And Fred, this is the theme. So when they've made 1,000 predictions and the 1,000 predictions turn out to be wildly off base, that should be an indication to them that they should question their worldview.
Yeah, there's
but
a, that's
they
a
never
clue.
Do.
They don't. That's a clue that there might be something wrong with their theory.
Right.
And Bob, what about the recent exoplanets we discovered? Aren't they going in the wrong direction? Doesn't that go against physics and an explosion or some kind of...
That's Huge. Yeah, they think that solar systems form from spinning nebulas, gas clouds condensing. If that's the case, then the planets are going to rotate, spin on their axis.
In the same direction.
Same direction as their star and the same direction as all the other planets, but they don't all, do they?
They don't, and not even in our own solar system, right?
We have planets that revolve on their axis backward, like Venus,
yep,
and Uranus. And then the hot Jupiters that they've been discovering, remember that? They said that gas giants could not form close to their stars. Well, lo and behold, they're finding plenty of those. And even planets that are orbiting backwards. What kind of catastrophe do you need, Fred, to have a planet orbiting its star backwards?
The physics just doesn't work.
The physics.
And that's why they're shocked and surprised.
Yeah.
And it's wildly unexpected.
And we've just reported on the study now about oxygen and nitrogen in the sun, where it turns out that they're different versions than we find on Earth and in the terrestrial planets. And that was another shocking discovery, because they're saying, well, lo and behold, the Earth and the terrestrial planets were made from a different substance than the sun was, but it's all supposed to come from the same nebula. So that's another shock. The isotopes of oxygen and nitrogen are different.
The shocks just never end.
They never end. And remember that the sun is spinning too slowly, and that the sun has 99% of the mass of the solar system, but it only has about 1% of the spin. And that's the opposite of what they predicted. Fred, these predictions, we're not talking about a woman's heart here that's inscrutable. We're not talking about a man's drug addiction. We're talking about physics and gravity. Prediction after prediction turns out to be dramatically falsified.
Yeah, dramatically false. And if they are, what does that say about the theory? Is it really a theory? No, it's a low-grade hypothesis.
Wow, that's powerful, and I think it's right on.
Okay, so Bob, I like this article too on amino acids. I wonder if there'll be some surprises here too.
Yeah, life is based on amino acids, right?
Yeah, and there's lots of them, right? There's hundreds of them.
Hundreds of possible acids, amino acids, to choose from if you're going to decide to make a living cell.
Yeah, but how many do we actually find in living cells?
Well, in the vast majority of organisms, like 99.999%, there is this set of 20 particular amino acids that are used in life.
Yeah, 20 of them. It's kind of like letters in our alphabet, right? Mm-hmm. The 20 amino acids form a protein, which is kind of like a word, right?
Yeah, a protein is sort of like a little machine.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So it turns out that researchers wanted to figure out, and this is reported at physorg.com, which is a mainstream physics source. Researchers wanted to find out, well, would life work with any 20 amino acids? Does it have to be this 20? And there's a really neat quote from this article, and this is from Stephen J. Freeland, who's a lead researcher from NASA's Astrobiology Institute at the University of Hawaii. Fred, what did Mr. Freeland say?
He said that we found that chance alone would be extremely unlikely to pick a set of amino acids that outperforms life's choice.
Right. So if you have chance and you're just going to start grabbing a bunch of amino acids, first of all, life uses left-handed amino acids. And they come in right and left-handed varieties, 50-50.
Yeah, and so life uses left-handed, so that's going against the naturalistic paradigm.
Right,
but
just
there's
chance.
20 of them that we need for life.
20?
So how does natural selection select these 20? How does that work?
They really have a problem. It's a chicken and egg problem. It's putting the cart before the horse, because they're saying there must have been some kind of a version of natural selection. Now, that's interesting, because natural selection can't help you start life.
Is there like version A, version B?
Well, there must be, because natural selection can only work when you have a robust reproduction mechanism already existing life. Survival of the fittest, that's a tautology, right? It doesn't really tell us anything. Survival of the fittest. Well, how do you know what the fittest is? Well, the ones that survive.
They survive.
Well, which ones survive? The ones that are the fittest. So it's a tautology. But, Fred, it can't help the beginning of life. Natural selection can't help. Natural selection only is in operation when you have organisms that are reproducing and then you have certain ones that survive. Well, when you don't have reproducing cells, which would have to be wildly complex, you're not going to have any natural selection. So they got this severe chicken and the egg problem.
Yeah, that's right. Again, I can't see how you can select 20 of these amino acids. Are they more healthy than the other amino acids?
No.
I mean, what's their survival advantage?
Right. Exactly.
You have to rely on dumb luck for this to happen. And we know the odds are astronomical to form the simplest protein. The odds are more than the number of molecules in the universe.
Forming a simple protein is so wildly unlikely. But then even if you have all the amino acids in the right order, now you have to fold the protein. And that process is wildly complex, with one out of a quadrillion possibilities of how you fold it. And then even if you did all that, you just have one dead protein. You're not going to have life.
Yeah, and again, remember, they're all left-handed, so they all have to be, you know, you got to keep flipping the coin as heads all the time.
And outside of a living organism, amino acids are 50-50. They're racemization, 50-50. When an organism dies, its amino acids, even in a plant, they start to return slowly, gradually. It'll take time, thousands of years. Some scientific journals have said, you know, it might take tens of thousands, maybe 100,000 years. At a wild stretch, maybe a million years, but eventually you're going to have 50-50 amino acids. Well, they're finding, like in fossils that are millions of years old, they're finding left-handed amino acids.
So they're just mostly finding left-handed, not the random 50-50 that happens over time or when you start with the process.
So when we're finding original biological material from tens to hundreds of millions of years ago, even a billion years ago, and we're finding they all have carbon-14 in them, and they're left-handed amino acids primarily. This is all evidence that these things are not millions and billions of years old, but it's all rapid, and it's evidence of the hand of God at work.
Absolutely. These living things have the amino acids in the right configuration. Mm. And what do you know? Things that have been dead for several thousand years still have them in the right formation. They can't be millions of years old.
Yeah, exactly. So to totally change topics, because Creation Magazine has such a great array of themes that they cover, and I highly recommend subscribing. We don't benefit here financially at all from CMI's ministry or Creation Magazine, but I really recommend getting a subscription. You'll love it. Comes once every 3 months. Do you get excited when yours comes in the mail?
Oh, absolutely. It's my favorite of all the Creation magazines.
Yeah, me too. Absolutely. So they have an article in here about Holland. And Fred, the Dutch, I tell you, I think I could say this because I'm part Dutch. The Dutch are messed up.
Oh, big time.
They are basket cases. This article is about their ministers and their doctors.
Yeah, one out of six of the ministers proclaim to either be agnostic or atheist.
Yeah, they can't figure it out.
Yeah. No.
Of their pastors, this is their clergy, one out of six are atheist or agnostic. They don't even know if there's a God, or they say there is no God. And we're talking about the pastors here. Then you go to the doctors in Holland. This is really scary what the Dutch government is doing there in the Netherlands. Fred, they are moving full steam ahead on euthanizing people, from children, babies, up to the elderly, euthanizing people, and now they're putting it on wheels.
Oh, man, I know they're talking about mobile units that drive to houses to euthanize people.
Yeah.
One of the things they said was if you're lonely, if somebody's complaining about being lonely, hey, you can get euthanized.
The Dutch Medical Association has said, look, if somebody is lonely, that's a good enough reason, you know, if they're really lonely, to kill them, to euthanize them. Fred, could you imagine the van pulls up and they said, hi, we're from the local hospital and we heard that you're lonely.
We're from Acme Euthanasia Incorporated.
You're lonely and we're here to help. And the guy says, oh, will you be my friend? And they're like, well, no, but we will kill you. Oh, wow. Do you like being lonely? Not really. All right, well, why don't you take this pill? Obviously, in Holland, the person who's lonely would have to tell his doctor that I'm lonely and I don't want to live, and they'd kill him.
Yeah, instead of doing the right thing. And, you know, there's cures for loneliness.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just amazing what steps are going to. And I think you were telling me earlier, Bob, that this isn't just the elderly.
Yeah, in fact, they've now euthanized their first child who's handicapped, a baby. They have nurses who are euthanizing people without their knowledge. The elderly are afraid of their medical field. that they might be euthanized against their will. The Journal of Medical Ethics, Fred, has just published an article by leading medical ethicists, and that today is an absurd term. Other than Dr. Diane Irving at Georgetown, most medical ethicists do not know right from wrong. But they are advocating that we make it legal to kill infants, babies, boys and girls, after they're born for any reason. And they're saying it should be legal, just like abortion is legal in America and Europe, that you don't need any reason. If you don't want your baby, you should have the right to kill the baby.
That's unbelievable. Wasn't there examples in the Bible? I mean, God said it never even occurred to them that they would throw their kids in the fire. Is this really much different than that?
He said that. He said, I would have never commanded it. It never entered my mind that you would take your children and kill them to Molech. They'd burn their children on the fire and the altar to Molech. So here are these leading scientists, professors, saying
of ethics.
And this is exactly what was in the New York Times. Fred, we sell a DVD here, Infanticide, in the pages of the New York Times. The New York Times ran a 3-page article. I read the whole article on TV.
I remember seeing that.
You remember?
Yeah, I do.
We still sell the DVD. I highly recommend it. The New York Times article is saying it should be legal to kill a baby after the baby's born in the first month or so for any reason.
And that was a 3-page article in the New York Times.
That's right. Sunday edition. So we have been warning people on the air for 20 years that when you disregard God's enduring command, do not murder, the consequences are deadly. You are now a murderer. The bloodlust of society is never satiated. They constantly want to kill more and more innocent people, including children, including lonely people. So, Fred, that's why personhood is essential. Personhood is the effort to force the government, not because the government wants to be loving or righteous, godly, but to force them to increase social tension over child killing so that they will enforce the God-given right to life for every innocent child, in fact, for every innocent person.
Yeah, and this 1 in 6 clergy in Holland, where do you think they got their worldview? It began with the compromise of Genesis.
Genesis, creation, and old earth, the Big Bang, Darwinism, evolution, the whole bit. And you know what, Fred? There are a lot of people who are saying that this is just postnatal abortion. That's what this article in the Journal of Medical Ethics, that's what this article calls it. They're saying this is just postnatal abortion. There's no difference between abortion and killing an infant. So we need to grow up and legalize infanticide. And Fred, in a way, it's good that they're calling it postnatal abortion because they're acknowledging that abortion is killing a baby.
Yeah.
He's sucking his thumb, playing with his toes, sleeping, dreaming. He knows his mother's voice. They learn the melodies of songs when they're in the mother's womb. You could go to Boulder, up the hill from where we are, and see Warren Hearn, the abortionist, pay him $20,000 and kill a late-term baby in the womb.
Jeez.
Yeah. And it's in the yellow pages. Abortion through 26 weeks, outpatient.
Wow.
Yeah. So these people are murderers.
Absolutely.
So, Fred, it's a rough story. It's a rough issue. And there it is right there in Creation.
Well, the impact, again, of not trusting God and the influence of evolution. It creates worldviews that lead to this kind of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
That's why this stuff's so important.
Fred, how about we go to something a little bit less depressing,
okay?
More focusing on the glory of God and his brilliance with the sonar of animals. We've talked about bats in the past. There's a great article here about dolphins and their ability via sonar.
Yeah, can't machines that we develop, these supercomputers, can't they do things much better than dolphins and bees? And
well, one of our sons, Cheryl and I, we're still raising 7 boys. 4 of them are grown now. But one of them was in the U.S. Navy, and he manned the sonar station 4 years. That's really fun in a submarine, and we're very proud of him. So, yeah, we have computers that do that and all this sophisticated engineering. And it turns out, according to scientists at Tel Aviv University and Brown University here in the U.S., that dolphins, bats, and mole rats do these things better than we can, even with our supercomputers.
So they're doing it much better. In fact, the supercomputers use thousands of times the amount of energy to do what these animals do.
Yeah, you got to cool the supercomputers with big air conditioners the size of your office. And they cost thousands of dollars to run on electricity.
And they run out usually after about 5 years or so.
Right. So here's a dolphin. How much energy does a dolphin's brain use? And a dolphin can see a tennis ball 260 feet away.
Wow, that's almost a football field.
Right. That's not quite as far as Tim Tebow can throw. So you got a tennis ball underwater in
ocean. It's in the ocean.
260 feet away. And the dolphin can, quote unquote, see it. He's seeing it with sound. Now, this is stunning. This is the kind of thing that our supercomputers cannot do nearly as fast as animals. But Fred, how about honeybees? They don't have sonar, but remember we talked comparing a honeybee to a supercomputer?
Yeah. And I don't think the computer did too well compared to the honeybees. And the calculations that they can do almost instantaneous. It's amazing.
Yeah, the honeybee takes hundreds of flowers and instantly calculates the least distance to get to each flower, even when the researchers added more flowers in while the honeybee is doing his work. They take some flowers out, add others. It recalculates effortlessly, immediately, and it takes a supercomputer like 24 hours to solve the same problem.
Yeah, so this isn't some blind instinct. The bee just flies around and finds a plant, right?
Right.
It uses trigonometric calculations in its brain.
Brilliant. And imagine how much more energy the supercomputer uses than the bumblebee. Because the bumblebee, imagine how small his brain is, how efficient it is, and how brilliant. He didn't need to develop that kind of mathematical capability to survive. Obviously, the bumblebee could survive just going from flower to flower. But no, they do it in a brilliant way to display the glory of God.
Did they go to bumblebee school?
Yes.
Or was that information there from the beginning?
It was there from the beginning. So Creation Magazine points out that enormous human ingenuity and money, resources, has gone into developing sonar and ultrasound imaging devices. And yet many claim that no intelligence whatsoever, no intelligence allowed, no ingenuity was needed for the origin of animal systems that are far superior to our systems. Fred, how many iterations would it take for random mutations to start devising a system where you're going to send out sound waves and you're going to hear them bounce back and you're going to start to process them in a symbolic way to determine what's out there?
Yeah, to take those symbols, like you said, and put them into an equation, right? To put them in something that's going to generate a response to this input.
Oh,
that's
wow.
That's amazing.
And when
you think that happened by chance is just, it's
ludicrous. It is ludicrous.
It is.
Evolution is a theory in crisis. And Fred, a bat has to emit such a loud sound that it can hear an echo off of a moth, say 30 feet away. Now imagine how loud you got to be to hear an echo off of a moth.
Wow.
You got to be pretty loud. In fact, it's so loud, now we don't hear it. It's above our threshold for our human auditory input. But it's so loud that the bat would go deaf by his own chirps that he's sending out. Every time he chirps, there's a muscle that covers his ears. And he releases these chirps thousands of times a minute. So how did that evolve? Because the bats would have gone deaf long before they realized they had to evolve a mechanism to protect their hearing. And then, Fred, how about this? You know, an echo, you've clapped your hands where you could really have a great example of hearing an echo coming back.
Yeah, like in a tunnel or something.
In a tunnel is a great example, or beeping your horn in a tunnel. If you have a big wall far away and you clap your hands, clap your hands, you'll hear an echo come back. But if you have a small wall close by, you'll hear the same kind of volume come back. So what are you hearing? Something big far away or something small close up? And in pitch darkness, the bat can tell because they vary their frequency. And it's all so brilliant the way God designed even the tiniest little insects have brilliant features.
Well, Bob, I think the evolutionists are actually onto something on this next story with pigs.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they've got a really good case here. What do you think?
Well, this is a funny one, Fred, and let's just dig right in.
Well, you know, for one, this one scientist who's studying pigs, he says that they have an innate preference for wallowing-like behavior and may thus have been instrumental in the evolution of whales. Wow, I never thought of that.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
So pigs,
they love to wallow in the mud, right?
Yeah, they do.
And why is that?
Well, this is a professor from a university in the Netherlands once again. Surprise, surprise.
Yeah.
And they're thinking, well, we all evolved from fish, so it could be that this motivation to be in water is something that causes the pigs to want to go in the mud. And I'm thinking, we all evolved from fish. You know, if anything evolved from fish, you'd think it'd be a whale.
Yeah.
If anything, but no, the whale evolved from a pig or a cow.
Or a cow, yeah.
Right. This is such wild storytelling. It's just absurd. And then they say, in fact, go way back before the fish, and life seems to have evolved, started in some mud pool.
In a mud pool. I wonder if these pigs, if they have a repressed memory, and that's why they want to go back to the mud.
That's what they're saying.
But, you know, maybe there's actually a scientific reason, because they don't have sweat glands, right?
They don't have sweat glands, so the mud is cool to them. And I like to think about the physics of that. Fred, you ever put your hand on, say, a marble countertop?
Yeah, or my feet on a marble floor.
Oh, yeah, your bare feet, and it's so cold, but then if you touch, let's say, a sweater that's laying on the floor, it's not cold.
Yeah, or you touch a wood counter. I think there's a freezer underneath my floor.
Yeah,
or is the temperature the same on the floor as there is on the table?
It's the exact same temperature. So if you put your hand on a wooden table and then your other hand on a marble countertop, it feels like the marble countertop is colder, but they're the ambient temperature of the room.
Yeah, the same temperature.
So what's going on is the same reason why the pigs like the mud, because the molecules in the, say, a steel appliance, like a refrigerator door or something, the molecules are very tightly packed together. So they don't make a good insulator for heat. When you touch something steel or a marble countertop, the heat is literally pulled out of your body so that it's being transferred to a pretty large area in that marble or in that steel. Whereas when you put your hand on a wooden table, the heat barely goes through the first half a millimeter or so of the wood.
And why is that? Because the wood has molecules closer together or farther
apart? Further apart. It's not so dense. It's sort of like there's millions of little air pockets, sort of.
So the denser you are, the colder you are.
Yeah, right. Gotcha. Or the more that you'll pull heat out of any source, including somebody's feet or their hands. So for the pig, dirt has a lot of air pockets in it. So you put your hand in a bucket of dirt, it doesn't feel cold. You pour room temperature water into that dirt, and you put your hand into a bucket of mud, and it feels cooler because you're heating up half of the bucket. The water is transferring the heat out of your body. So the pigs, they like the mud because it's dense. It's very dense.
So it's not a repressed memory of their fish-like past.
I think that's a stretch.
Okay.
I think it has
to do they were onto something here, but I think you're right. This is I wonder if they're surprised that, you know, pigs are actually well-designed by the creator.
Yeah, so the pigs evolved from fish, and the whales evolved from pigs.
Yeah.
It's just such evolutionary storytelling. Thank you, Fred Williams. It's always a joy to have you in studio. Check out our website, realsciencefriday.com, and help out financially if you can. Hi, this is Bob Enyart with Real Science Friday. You can get great science materials from us, DVDs, debates, books, all from our website, kgov.com, or by calling us 1-800-8-ENYART. So here's a list of what you can get. DVDs from Illustra Media that we carry, The Privileged Planet, Unlocking the Mystery of Life, and Darwin's Dilemma. And then there are the two fabulous DVDs from Dr. Carl Werner on Evolution, The Grand Experiment, Living Fossils. You'll want to see those. And then Spike Passaris, formerly with the U.S. Military Space Program, What You Aren't Being Told About Astronomy. And then there's the BEL debates, Bob Debates an Evolutionist, Dr. Eugenie Scott on DVD, and a book, Does God Exist?, Bob Enyart debates atheist Zaketh, a psychologist. We also have two DVDs on our seminar, Does God Exist? And then Mount St. Helens, The Explosive Evidence for Catastrophe. We also have our debate on the age of the earth, where I got to debate a mathematician from CU up in Boulder and a geophysicist on this MP3 CD. And finally, my favorite science book, In the Beginning, by Dr. Walt Brown. Just call us at 800-8-ENYART, 800-836-9278, or check out our online store in the science department, either at kgov.com or realsciencefriday.com.